If you're a singing teacher or voice specialist with a keen desire to enrich your knowledge in an inclusive, supportive, and caring learning environment, the CCM Vocal Pedagogy Institute offers a unique 9-day in-person training program that combines science-informed training techniques with a holistic approach to artist development. You will be guided through a carefully crafted step-by-step process of training techniques delivered by a group of dedicated educators, which includes singers, voice teachers, speech-language pathologists, and other integrated specialists, all united by a core set of values and pedagogical beliefs. Housed at Shenandoah University in Winchester, Virginia, the CCM Vocal Pedagogy Institute program is delivered in person with access to online continuing education courses that focus on a wide variety of topics. All courses include graduate credit from Shenandoah University. So if you're ready to join a warm and welcoming community that unites singers and teachers, irrespective of skill set and experience, enroll now and join the 2024 cohort at the CCM Vocal Pedagogy Institute. To learn more, simply visit ccminstitute.com. It's Marissa Lee here, and I'm so excited to be sharing today's interview round episode with you. In these episodes, our brilliant lineup of guests will include healthcare practitioners, voice educators, and other professionals who will share their stories, knowledge, and experiences within their specialized fields to empower you to live your best life. Whether you're a member of the voice community or beyond, your voice is your unique gift. It's time now to share your gift with others, develop a positive mindset, and become the best and most authentic version of yourself to create greater impact. Ultimately, you can take charge. It's time for you to live your best life. It's time now for a voice and beyond. So, without further ado, let's go to today's episode. The internet is a minefield of information, but it is also rife with misinformation. And when it comes to voice teaching, as an industry, we are not excluded from the bombardment of misinformation. Whether it's a YouTube video, an Instagram post, a TikTok video, or a post on a social media forum, there is an inundation of misinformation regarding how to sing, voice training techniques, and singing teachers and coaches themselves showing us how they believe it should be done. We are in an unregulated industry, and anyone can claim to have discovered the holy grail to vocal greatness. Therefore, this week on A Voice and Beyond, I asked Chris Johnson to return to the show as our special guest and voice geek to spill the tea and shed the truth about some of the most widely spread myths that apply to singing. Chris Johnson is an internationally acclaimed singing teacher and highly respected vocal coach who has been trained in manual therapy, massage, myofascial release, and his training perspective respects the whole self. He is the founder of singing teacher training organization, Teach Voice, and co-founder of one of the most popular podcasts for singers, The Naked Vocalist. Chris has also had a professional performance career and truly understands the demands on singers today and the vital role voice training plays in developing and sustaining healthy vocal production. This is a two-part episode, and in this part one episode, Chris is going to do some myth busting around topics such as the role of singing teacher versus vocal coach, tension, the role of the breath, and voice placement. It is a fascinating and most informative episode, and part two will be released in the weeks to come. So, without further ado, let's go to today's episode. Welcome to A Voice and Beyond. We have Chris Johnson in the house. How are you, Chris?
I'm very well, thank you.
You're giving yourself a cheer. I like that.
I am, yeah. I need to create some vibes because, you know, I can't hear the audience out there, so I have to create my own.
I'll give you a clap.
Okay, thank you.
How about a round of applause?
Thank you.
It was round.
And it was cracking.
Yes. Now, Chris, we're going to be very serious tonight. We have quite an episode that we've planned for the audience because we're going to be doing some myth busting. People are literally being bombarded with information at present. There's all the forums on social media. Everyone has an opinion. And all the opinions are so different, so vast, so varied. And then you have YouTube. And my singers are often tempted to go and have a look on YouTube and they come back with the most weird and wonderful things. And I go, what are you doing? Oh, I saw this on YouTube.
And something about YouTube is I do get brought back down to earth sometimes with how the industry works. And so It's not unusual for me to say work with a client who might be on a major label.
Yes.
Or, you know, somebody well-known in a tour or something like that. And the first time we meet each other, it would be, hey, so what are you working on? Do you have a vocal warm-up at the moment or a regime? And they say, yeah, we've got one. And even if they're like a high-end singer, the amount of times they say, I just get it all from YouTube.
A high-end singer.
Yeah, so even somebody who's like, you know, selling like in the hundreds of millions of streams on Spotify, is that the warm-up will be quite often from YouTube. So I've got to remind myself that actually sometimes it doesn't matter what level of career that person is at. Mm-hmm. YouTube is actually one of the main resources for people to get their warm-ups. And so that means if you're on YouTube and you're spreading great stuff, you're going to do good in the world. But if you're on YouTube spreading disinformation,
yes,
it could permeate out quite badly into all areas.
I only have one comment to make on that. These people that are selling millions of their songs, can't they afford a vocal teacher? Are the record companies cashing in that much that these people can't go and get a proper paying like vocal coach?
Yeah, I don't know. I think there's so many factors, isn't it? Sometimes it's like, you know, I'm a natural talent, so I want to preserve that. Some people say, especially managers often say, oh, don't go with a vocal coach because they will take every ounce of individuality from you.
Yes. And
I can understand why that's been said, of course, in the past completely. Or it might just be not really see the value, or don't do anything until something goes wrong, which is really the biggest one, isn't it? So
yep. Don't fix what isn't broken.
Yeah.
Yeah, essentially. Okay, Chris, so you're an internationally acclaimed singing teacher and highly experienced vocal coach. So we're going to go straight to myth number one. And why I have you doing all this myth busting is because not only have you had this massive career in the teaching realm, but you also had a performance career. You approach your teaching
respecting the whole self because you've trained in different modalities, and you're a geek.
Thank you.
You are a total, like, true, proper voice geek with a sense of humour, which is very unusual.
Great. I'm ticking some boxes there. Thank you very much.
Oh, my gosh. You've ticked just about all of them.
That's my aim.
I'll find one that's unticked as we go.
I'm gonna trick you into believing I am a blemishless work of art.
Oh, look at you. Of course you are. Okay. So let's go to myth number one. And I think you can answer this because you are an acclaimed singing teacher as well as vocal coach. Now, some voice teachers call themselves vocal coaches, while others claim to be singing teachers exclusively, and they say that they don't do any vocal coaching. So is there a point in the training of a singer that the two do meet?
Yeah, I think there has to be, doesn't there? It would be quite awkward in a lesson when a particular need arises that would require you to switch from teacher, which is, if we just kind of clarify it, I guess, singing teaching being that you are able to instruct somebody on how to use their voice to achieve a functional goal. That could be anything from extending range, you know, the technical tick box of that. But then the coach would usually help the singer make decisions whereby they use those skills that they have in order to deliver songs in different ways. And that could be stylistically, it could be melodically, artistically. So they're the distinctions. And it would be quite awkward then if in the middle of a session when you're done teaching somebody some range stuff, they're like, oh, how should I deliver this song? And you're like, oh, no, I don't do that. And I know sometimes that might be the case because it might be, I'm really just a classical teacher. I don't really do R&B, and that would be cool. Mm-hmm. But I still believe that there's going to be some opinion delivered by that teacher to go, oh, maybe I think you should try it like this or try it like that. So
exactly.
Yeah, it's going to be very hard to keep a hard border between singing teacher and vocal coach.
Yes.
Yeah.
100%. And I claim to be both. There are times where I need to have the singing teacher hat on, and there are times where I need to be a vocal coach because we're working on repertoire where we may need to make style choices, or I have to help them make decisions in the lesson as to the way they want to deliver a song or what the correct accent is for something. I mean, there's so many things that we do as vocal coaches. And sometimes the two do kind of marry up almost when you are working on repertoire and you use the repertoire to teach them something functional, or you use the repertoire to do the technical training as well, which I do at times to almost do a two-in-one, to multitask without them realizing that I'm multitasking. I've got both hats on at the same time throughout that one song.
Yeah, agreed. And I don't know how you felt about this in your career, but I think really just because of the way I grew as a singer, I think I grew most of my stylistic skills fairly late on in my singing career. The early part of my singing career, I was actually singing the same genre of music all of the time. I also wasn't teaching in a very varied environment. So I was quite uncomfortable with being a vocal coach in the beginning. I just wanted to teach the technique. You're the artist. You can do all that. But where I actually ended up learning from a lot of different stylistic singers, I actually ended up, you know, baptism of fire. I ended up teaching a part of a diploma course where I had to teach style and improvisation, having really not really taught it in a structured way, but rather just delivered it as part of, like, you know, oh, you're in a rock band this week as a function singer, so you've got to sound rocky, you know all these bits and pieces, but teaching it in a more structured way.
Yes.
That was stress and anxiety inducing to do that for a year. But it didn't have to teach me a lot. I mean, oh my goodness, I learned a lot. And then I ended up actually singing different styles myself as people would ask me to do more varied things out of the band.
Yes.
From, you know, through musical theatre to slightly more very poppy stuff, rock stuff, soul, which was I was always into. So I became much more comfortable with being a vocal coach over time, and learning pentatonic scales and musicality. Like, that's such a great tool to kind of dabble yourself into being becoming more of a coach.
Yes.
And you don't, you just need to be able to know the scales. It's actually really, it's really rewarding to show somebody how to navigate themselves around things like pentatonic and blues scales, and then, mm-hmm. then create their own melodies. Mm-hmm. It's wonderful. And so I really actually started to enjoy the coaching. And when someone comes in with a song and says, oh, I'd love to figure out some new ways to do this, it's just so fun. I love it when people come in to say that.
Yeah. Yes.
You just get on the piano, start faffing around, few ideas, creativity starts flowing. Oh, it's so fun.
Yes, I love that side of it. And I feel that I started out as a vocal coach because my career journey is different to most. I always say my career started when I was 5 years old, when I started listening to the music. And, you know, coming from a migrant family, we were listening to Italian folk songs and arias. We have Mario Lanza playing. Mm. Then my brother belonged to a record club. So we would have pop, rock, blues, R&B, everything. And I was listening to this music on a daily basis. So my ear is really well attuned to all the style elements and every nuance in so many of these styles. And I feel really at home in that vocal coaching arena. Mm. And if something's not right in terms of style and delivery, it's like, you know, because we do have to be authentic to style.
Yeah.
You can improvise, but the bones have to be there. You have to respect the integrity of that music.
Yeah. Oh, and I think that's a big subject, isn't it?
Yes.
I think I saw Brian Gill talk about that. It may be even been on this podcast.
Mm-hmm. I have had Brian.
Yeah. Well, he's talking about, you know, you can sing any style you want, and it's like, that's not quite true. And I really resonated with what you said about that, because at the end of the day, you have to live with something deeply for a long time. And
yes,
and it's fair enough, you know, when, like, say in the world of musical theater, when if you've been a musical theater trained singer, but you have to sing in a bluesy style show, or then you have to sing in a poppy style show, yes, they can make bluesy and poppy style sounds, but blues and pop fans would still notice it as not really being blues or pop.
They wouldn't buy it.
No, they wouldn't buy it. And it's no offense. That, I mean, it's,
no.
The job you're doing is good for the theatre, but it doesn't make you a blues singer.
No, absolutely.
And that's the confusion I think people are having, is like, yeah, I can do blues. I even saw on a forum one time, it was a classical singer who's saying, I'm comfortable with singing all styles. But then what it transpired was, well, yeah, of course I sound like Pavarotti when I do them, but I can still sing them all. And what they were doing was confusing singing the style,
yes,
with singing the pitches and the words.
Yes.
That doesn't make you, it doesn't make you a blues singer or a rock singer. I can sing all the high notes, but they wanted to preserve their own sound, and they didn't realise that, well, that doesn't mean you sing the genre then.
It would be like me singing classical music and sounding like I'm a rock singer at heart, and singing classical music, it doesn't work. I don't know mm-hmm. what I'm doing. I can mimic the sound, but is it a good sound, or the accepted, does it fall within the ideals of that bel canto, the Eurocentric Western classical sound? Mm-hmm. No, I sound weird. Absolutely weird. But no, I think, you know, it's important that we have that sound, whatever sound we're teaching. It's almost like it has to be in our bodies. We do have to immerse ourselves in that music and continue to do so, because our, you know, the landscape of music styles that fall in CCM especially is growing at a phenomenal rate. Mm-hmm. There's a new sub-style. There's styles coming out. There was, I mean, I've heard of this bedroom pop, dark pop. There was another pop that came out the other day, and I've, what is this? Like, do you guys just make this up, or is it a real thing?
Yeah, no, I hear those. And it, pop is starting to catch up with rock as far as the amount of subgenres that are within it. You know, rock used to be like, there's so many little categories of rock or subgenres. But yeah, dream pop is another one that I work with people quite a bit.
That, I think that was it.
Yeah, that's been around for a while, actually. Yeah.
So when the first one came in and said, "Oh, I sing dark pop," I said, "Oh, do you turn the lights out?" Then the next one came in and said, "I sing bedroom pop." And I said, "Oh, do you, have you tried the dining room?"
Oh, my goodness.
And dream pop, I just want to say, maybe you want to try seeing while you're awake.
Do they look at you with a blank expression?
No, my students get to know me quick smart.
Okay, cool. Because I try my dad jokes on people as well, and I sometimes get a laugh and sometimes get a deadpan.
Yeah.
I'll say it anyway, though.
Exactly. You know what? We have to entertain people while we're teaching.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, let's go to myth number two. Tension is bad. So is there a time when it is good for us?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. Tension is part of the integrity of something, isn't it? And certainly as we are living beings full of tissue, fascia, all the things that hold us together, there's a tension balance that allows things to work optimally. So the problem with tension is, in the name of eradicating all feelings of any muscle effort at all, singers and coaches and advice that's out there on the internet would lead people to do exercises that just turn them basically into flaccid things, floppy, flaccid voices that have no interest or no dynamic. It's just, and they try and sing with that. And the confusion out there is lost between sort of tension and tenseness. Or, you know, I often make the distinction between tension and tenseness. Does it feel tense to the point? Tense is normally it's not comfortable. And it's inhibiting the movement of other things. It's putting a tenseness into the system rather than a tension. Because at the end of the day, the vocal folds raise pitch by applying tension. That's how you raise pitch. The larynx needs to move up and down from muscles becoming active.
Yes.
And in rock singing, say, and really high range singing, singers go into what would look like hypertension, so a lot of tension in the muscles or activity, but it's a necessary hyperactivity, if you like, to achieve the goal. But if it's short-lived, and we have things like cool-down procedures whereby you can go all flaccid, right? It's nice to be able to go flaccid if you'd like to. Let's not carry on with that word too much.
No, I don't want to be flaccid. Don't ever make me flaccid in my life.
I know, when we have conversations with singers, I only really need to say that word once before it just hits home. But having cool-downs and, you know, ways to reset.
Yes.
Is then necessary hyperfunction is then not a problem. And I think we should talk about things like, sometimes the sport analogy is good, because at the end of the day, every sport has its impact. It has its necessary impacts, but every sport has its way to recover. Every sport has its treatments. Every sport has its injuries. And I don't think we can expect singers to go out into the wide variety of genres and stay completely within utter comfort the whole time.
Yes.
Everybody is going to be stretching the boundary at some point. And it's whether they know how to approach overstretching themselves in the right way, like not when you're wrecked from the day before. Right, you choose plan B on those days, but you know, if you're feeling really good and you know your voice has been great for a while, if you overstretch yourself a bit, it doesn't cost you so much. It's not that we have to worry. It's when singers can't see the gathering problems of doing that too often and too much, where then things do go from into tenseness that doesn't resolve day to day. and comes along with different stuff. So I think it's important to make that distinction between tension and tenseness.
Yes. So what about then when people blame tension for something going wrong with the sound? Or should I say the singer runs into problems? I'm trying to train myself out of saying words like right and wrong, good and bad. Mm-hmm. So what if a singer runs into some kind of challenge that is being caused by tenseness? Usually mm-hmm. it's either tongue root, that's a big one, or some laryngeal stuff, or it could even be something going on with the upper body, like the shoulders. Yeah. When do we still want that to be flaccid?
The thing about tenseness is about how it arrives. So let's put it this way. The way I tend to work with teachers and also with singers is that we have to look at symptom or cause sometimes because it's not always clear.
Mm.
And when it comes to tension, let's say, tension creates a balance. The nervous system knows that. That's why if you have an injured muscle, say, on one side of your body, say it's in your leg, other muscles will upgrade their effort to compensate for that injured muscle or yes. missing function, right? Mm-hmm. So you can't stop that unless you just lay in your bed. You're going to have to compensate to carry on with life. And if people are like, okay, I've got to get rid of the tenseness in that muscle, it's like, well, you can't until you're recovered from the injury unless you just lay in your bed all day.
Mm.
And so singers are the same. Singers, sometimes let's say they may have had some idea about singing that might not quite fit with their physiology. Let's mm-hmm. say they don't really use their chest voice very much because mm-hmm. it's a pain in the bum. So they use a lighter register and use, what are you saying?
Sorry, I'm Australian. I have a wicked humour. You see, they don't use their chest voice because it's a pain in the bum, and I'm thinking that's not singing.
Yeah, we're getting Chris, this is very convoluted. Okay, because then close yes. a pain in the neck that'll
yes,
do
good.
It
way better.
A pain in the neck, but when somebody doesn't use some kind of important function, I think, to keep the voice stable and to involve the whole vocal mechanism in something mm-hmm. that needs to be there, the nervous system picks up that slack and it can add tension into the system from knee-jerk constrictions and tightnesses.
Yes.
And singers can spend, and teachers as well, can spend years trying mm-hmm. to get rid of this tenseness.
Mm-hmm.
Not realizing it absolutely needs to be there mm-hmm. for that singer to function. And so again, wow. if we look at tension, if tension's looked at its basic, like on its basic level, that's tense, I need to relax it. It doesn't really acknowledge the reasons why that is there. And if it constantly returns, I implore people to look at the idea that tension or tenseness there looks like it's probably necessary because something else underlying for stability or function is missing. And that may be something that is physiological, something that is not necessarily chosen, or it could be conceptual, which is the mm-hmm. singer has an idea of singing that actually creates an issue within their yes. own voice.
Yes.
So yeah, when we get into tension and tenseness, we have to get into, is it a compensation or not for a conceptual or physiological issue? Mm-hmm. And that's why mm-hmm. we can't just get rid of it. It's not a thing to just get rid of. It's a thing to explore.
Yes. And sometimes it can be a manipulation.
Oh, how do you mean?
Well, I had a student that came to me. I'm still teaching her. She's in third year now, but she had a bleat. Her vibrato was really, really, really quick. She sounded like a lamb, like mm-hmm. but a lamb that was on steroids.
Right.
And, you know, and I was trained that if someone has a very, very fast vibrato or a very slow vibrato, there's some sort of tension somewhere. So I was just trying to figure out how I was going to calm down this vibrato. And one day I was at the piano and I just got her to sing ga on a 5-note descending scale. So ga, 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 right? No vibrato. And I turned around and I said, there's no vibrato. Oh, no, but I don't need to use vibrato. I said, why do you feel the need to use it in your singing? Oh, because it's not singing unless I have vibrato.
Okay.
And she was manipulating, and that manipulation, whatever she was doing to achieve a desired sound that she thought was a good sound, was creating the tension.
Mm. I love that.
Yeah, so I think sometimes, and I have another one at the moment, when she does melismas, she is, the veins are popping out, like the laryngeal tension, and get her to sing on a straight tone, it is very clear. So she is manipulating to create those melismas. So it's very interesting because she feels that she sounds amazing.
Yeah, and that comes into something which is quite, I think, important is you know, how the brain works in terms of making tasks easier. Like if for someone to do melismas, you know, parts of that they let off the nervous system patterns take over because they've sang that style and those patterns routinely. So there is some letting go and letting the nervous system take over the movement, just like we let the nervous system take over walking. You know, it's it works on a predictive way, but if we have to move, if we have to move each leg as we go, obviously that would take ages, so riffs tend to be slower when people do that. And also they're more tense because you can't just let it run fluidly on its in its predictive kind of function in the nervous system. So it's like, I think that's really important to get people out of consciously managing every aspect of movement in their voice.
Yes.
Just like an ice skater lets go to momentum. You know, you don't, you just have to let go and take momentum, and singers need to take momentum in the same way. I think they need to let go to the momentum of singing and see actually what forces they can't feel or control actually carry them quickly. It's like, oh, it takes a lot of trust to do that.
Yes. And it's like a dancer executing pirouettes. Sure, you know, they have the preparation in the plié, but then once they're in that spin, you just let yourself go. I know my daughter used to be able to do six.
Wow.
And she's down to three now, or four.
Right.
But that's another example of just letting go. And I liked what you called it, managing. I call it manipulating.
Right, okay.
But I like, what did you call it, managing?
Yeah, I just call it managing your voice, which is just not wonderful. But if you learn something brand new, you do go into management mode. And then you experience it a couple of times, and then you gradually have to start letting it go to, okay, once you've experienced it a few times and in different ways, you can build the brain's ability to predict the outcome of when you next do it. Your brain knows, it knows it. And if there's a prediction, there's an experience of it, and especially in different environments. You've done it on stage, you've done it in the practice room, you've done it whilst moving and standing still, you've done it whilst whiny or woofy or some other way. You know, you build that prediction engine, and then you can let go of managing because prediction takes over, which is really, really cool. So you do have to sometimes switch to management mode when things are tricky.
Yes.
But singers often never get out of it. They control it, stay with control, and then they live like that forever. And then they always come to me with limitations that are usually quite similar.
Yes. Okay. We're going to move on to myth number three, which is shouting is unhealthy. Okay, so I'm just going to start here with, I mean, one of the main reasons children have nodules is because they're shouting in the playground. So is it specifically for a particular age group that they shouldn't be shouting, or is shouting unhealthy or healthy for everybody?
I think it's good to talk about this because in the name of raising your voice. So yes, raising your voice in certain ways will add more impact onto your voice. And so again, done often and a lot, yes, there can be abrasions and injuries that happen on the voice. But once again, especially from the world of singing, that information is taken and it's taken to never raising your voice. So it just gets completely distorted into that's unhealthy. It's a bit like tension as well. All tension's bad. It comes along with these things, but it's misunderstood. And so everyone goes for no tension. The amount of singers I've met who go, I just try never to raise my voice ever. Mm-hmm. And what they don't realize is that sort of atrophies your ability as a singer. So we weren't born with frigging phones. You know, we didn't start our evolutionary journey being able to phone each other. We did have to call across mountains.
Yes.
We did have to.
Yes.
You know, when we would work on, like, you know, I guess farming, you know, early farming, it used to be like, catch the goat. You know what I mean? Like, the goat's running off, get the goat, or there's a wolf.
Get your own bloody goat.
Yeah. So we have all that. And
yes.
And I believe that part of my job for singers is to teach them how to be loud. I teach them how to, I guess sometimes shouting, yes, it's not a great word, but I teach them to use their voice at volume safely again.
Yes.
And they're absolutely petrified of doing it. But for the singers, for their robustness, for them to understand, oh, actually, this can be supported by resonance. When I approach it, it doesn't have to be a crunch onset that goes, yeah, like that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to work like that. It
yes.
can feel actually very easy. And then the volume generated is like, whoa, wow, that's pretty big. That's pretty big. And we're not going to do it all day long. That's a 1 minute part of your warm up to check back in with your ability to produce volume.
Mm-hmm.
And the volume you're going to produce in your singing probably is going to be, you know, 2/3 of that.
Mm-hmm.
Or something, and it's going to contain vibrato, which might make it even just a little less intense. So I think as a bunch of singers and how we teach singers their different functional facilities, calling is a function that's absolutely necessary, and we evolved with it. So if we're scared to use our voice in a loud way, we wither, and singers want a belt, but they don't want to raise their voice in their life, and so it becomes a constant argument in their brain and their body, and they never really achieve healthy belting because they can't really call for a taxi or something.
Mm. What I've found really interesting, sometimes it can be associated with culture.
Yeah.
For example, I come from an Italian family, so we all had to raise our voices to be heard, you know, and plus two, we use the full range of the voice. We'd speak up high and then we speak down here. And like the voice was moving in dynamics and pitch all the time because that's how we express ourselves. We're highly excitable. So when at 5 years old, I was listening to that music, it was not a big deal for me to be loud. I was belting. I didn't know it was a thing till I started university 15 years ago, but I had belted my whole life. I'd been loud. I was hitting money notes because nobody told me I couldn't.
Yeah.
No one had placed that limitation on me, and I had a fully fledged career, and I was loud when I needed to be loud, and it never hurt my voice. But I don't think I was in my head about it. And I think that's the biggest difference, is when you get in your head about something or someone places a limitation on you, whether it's you, you know, you create this limiting belief or someone else imposes limitations on you. I think that's when we run into strife. And I think belting is one of those things.
Yeah.
You know, everyone has such a different opinion about belting. And to be honest, I just don't know what the problem is.
Mm-hmm.
I truly don't.
No, it's hard. And I think it's just the confusion, isn't it? It's the causation correlation thing. Yeah, if someone belts a lot and then they get an injury, that it's just always linked by the purists as being that's the reason why. That's the reason why.
100%.
You know? And it's done so often, it's actually quite irritating. Isn't it?
Oh, I get irritated. I do get irritated. Highly irritated. Yes.
Yeah.
Because people don't realize that we all have alive. And classical singers get injuries also, but no one knows about them. It's only mm-hmm. that a lot of the singers that do sustain vocal injuries are high profile and they're in the media.
Yeah, and I actually had a workshop with a really great speech therapist called Oliver Frischknecht. Came in. Oh. I'm really proud of that, by the way.
Yeah, I'm proud.
He came in and he actually led with Jonas Kaufmann, is he a baritone, I think? A really, really good opera singer, one of the most famous, I think, in recent times. Mm-hmm. And he's had two rather notable vocal meltdowns. And one of them was he was singing with Wagnerian singers who are well known for being incredibly loud. They were the first bunch of sort of singers, I think, to be able to sing so strong that they could sing over the newly 65-piece orchestra or whatever. Because orchestras just grew and grew and grew over the whatever century it was. The orchestras got bigger and more grand. So the singers had to get more and more robust to just even handle it. So Wagnerian singers are known for being really robust. So, and Jonas Kaufmann was very honest in saying, I was basically around all these Wagnerian singers who were banging. I tried to compete and I absolutely ruined my voice. Like gone. And he was like, I'm going to give up. But what I love about that is he came back from it, obviously, mm-hmm. but he was so open with it. He was so cool. He really let that whole stigma sort of come down a little bit about classical, and even the most revered singers now, they get it, and they get it in situations that we all do. I'm impressed by them. I'm trying to compete with them. I'll try and sing like them. Oh no, that's not what my voice is.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. Imagine how many goats a Wagnerian singer could get.
Yeah. Yeah. They were shepherds in a previous life.
They would have so many goats, there'd be no goats left.
That is, that'll be our thing for today, for this week. Yeah, we're going to do the get the goat exercise. We'll be just 1 minute, okay?
Can we create a get the goat exercise by the end of this?
When it's not the vibrato singer again, is it? Because this could go wrong again.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah. Okay, so let's visit the other end of the spectrum then. What about whispering?
Well, whispering, I think whispering can be quite challenging, of course, on the voice, because whispering is one of those things that obviously has a very low volume and a very great difficulty carrying over noise. Mm-hmm. So the problem with whispering is that if you were to do it, say, quite a lot, the amount of sort of hyperfunction that can put in the voice, like when people whisper, they often have to do it like really high. Like they have to try and boost these high frequencies in whispering, and that mm-hmm. puts a rather lot of genuine tenseness mm-hmm. into the system to try and get some output to mm-hmm. compete. So whispering is very challenging in that sense.
Yes.
Whereas, you know, it's not as challenging as calling, because calling is so vibrant. Often people need to realize that, oh, I don't need to make half as much effort to make that loud. Mm-hmm. There is no opportunity to do that in whispering. You have to make it very high effort to make it work.
Yes.
Constantly. So that's why I think their whispering is sort of more silently dangerous, you know, in that sense.
And I associate whispering almost with breathiness. And mm-hmm. I was at the Grammys a couple of months ago.
I knew you would find an opportunity to say that.
Come on, it's the first one. I've waited.
No, it's amazing.
I've waited a little while before I dropped the G word. So the person I could not listen to was Billie Eilish.
Right.
Because I understand that the song that she sang in the Barbie movie was written at a point in the movie where Barbie was showing all her vulnerabilities. And that breathiness was for impact and to portray where the character was at right in that moment in time. But I was thinking to myself, and I was sitting with another singing teacher who works with high-profile singers, I was thinking, how sustainable is that surely she doesn't sing like that on tour.
Yeah. I mean, one thing we can't ignore is, you know, I said about the sports analogy, some sports have their own impacts, some sports need their own cool downs. And breathy singers, they do typically get their voices dry and tired.
Mm-hmm.
And like you've just sort of hinted at there, is that when you're on a heavy schedule, let's say you're on a tour, and
yes.
The thing about Billie Eilish being on tour is her sound in her ear will be absolutely fantastic. Unbelievable. So her ability to not overpush her voice, I guess, on tour in that breathy way,
mm-hmm.
it will be great, because then the sound crew will make it sound incredible.
Yes.
But if you take that breathy singer and you put them in the open mic night with no monitors, terrible sound, a sound crew or person that doesn't give a shit, and really loud drummer, they struggle so bad. And so the tendency for breathy singers to then force the breathy voice to compete with that, and so mm-hmm. they can hear themselves, they're in a lot of danger of that. And I think that's why breathy singers also, it is a less efficient way of singing. It does require you to probably practice clear voice in your off season or in your time off much more often, but that often gets missed out. And the challenges of the stage, it claims a lot of breathy voices. It puts them in the graveyard, because they just don't get the environment that someone like Billie Eilish would get, where they can accommodate that lack of output with cracking sound and output
yes.
in the system. And that's why we have microphones. So with microphones, it can be sustainable, and with the right sort of balance work on the off season, it can be sustainable,
mm-hmm.
but it doesn't come without impact. And the impact's worse for singers who are amateur on a stage than it is for professionals.
Absolutely. All right. Myth number four, singing starts with the breath. It all starts with the breath.
Of course it does. Yeah, I know. That is the argument, isn't it? Well, you can't sing without a breath coming through it. So it would be understandable why we could say everything starts with the breath. But in the nervous system, it can be a very different story, can't it?
Mm.
In the way that the nervous system fires, it starts with the voice.
Well, isn't it a neuromuscular activity? So it starts at
conception. Yeah.
And then that fires everything else?
Yeah, of which it fires the vocal folds coming together and stretching to the pitch first.
Before the breath.
Yeah, which sort of reinforces that the breath is there to calibrate itself around the valve, around the register. So the register is very important. The valve is very important. And the breath, yes, we take it in first in preparation for this to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But really, the configuration of the voice is higher in the priority, or higher in the order of events in the nervous system than the breathing is. So the breath begins and then calibrates itself quickly around what's going on at the vocal fold level. So the breath is actually sort of saying to the vocal folds, what do you need? You know, you're first, what do you need? What can I give you? And if we think of it like that, that's why it's probably good to call it support in that way, because support means you're not the main event.
Mm-hmm.
You're there to make sure the main event can happen. And so, and that would say then in the hierarchy of things, you're probably not first.
Yes. Interesting.
Yeah, it's cool, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is cool. See, I didn't know that. Should I have known that? Am I a bad teacher?
No, but I mean, I've been drawn attention by Heidi Moss, who's a great teacher.
Yeah, she's my buddy.
Oh, cool.
I stayed at her house not so long ago in Napa Valley.
Oh, of course you did, in San Francisco.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, she posted quite some time ago now some research. I think it was Edward Chang is the researcher, but it just reinforces the sort of the hierarchy of events that go into making or vocalizing. And so they see, yeah, the firing of the nerves and everything else that are associated with the closure of the vocal folds and in setting the length and tension. And also along with the articulators
yes.
in the same part of the brain. So it's like the larynx and the articulators, they all set in position a bit earlier than breath, and then breath comes just shortly afterwards.
Very interesting.
That sort of reinforces why some schools of thought are like, okay, yes, a continuous breath or a consistent breath can create a consistent or continuous tone. That's cool. But there's a whole bunch of other people out there who are like, the breath will sort itself out. And they're not wrong either. They're kind of probably intuitively working on what I've just described. But then there are physiological, cultural, postural, health, any challenge you can imagine that means that singers can't just live in one camp or the other. Occasionally, we just have to help someone alter their breath pattern.
Yes.
And sometimes we just have to help them alter their voicing pattern and the breath calibrates itself perfectly around it. If we can't step into one side or the other for singers, then we're unable to help the greatest amount of people. So I think we can acknowledge what the nervous system likes to do, but then we have to acknowledge what stops the body from carrying it out is the other problem that we face.
Yes. So when we have a breathy onset, because obviously this calibration is the thing that is the start of phonation. So this is all going on before we've made sound. So when you have someone that has a breathy onset, which means the breath has kicked in before the sound, as everyone knows, what has misfired there? Is it a misfire?
It could. Quite often it's conceptual. That's turned itself into a habit. Mm-hmm. And habit has become subconscious. So it's, or it might not have even been chosen in the beginning. It might have been emulated from artists and then it becomes a pattern. And one of the greatest lines that I've heard a teacher say is Robert Sassuma. And I always say this line is, you don't have to think to get into a pattern, but you have to think to get out of one.
Oh, 100%.
And that's as such, when it comes to breathy onsets, it's or any kind of vocal problem, it's like, I know you didn't choose this. This is a real pain in the bum, but you're going to have to choose to get out of it. And so it feels like, I didn't do this. Why do I have to choose to get out of it? It's a bit like that, but that's just the way it is. So when it comes to breathy onsets, if they are uncontrollable and unwanted, then you do get back into consciously applying what would be the closure. And I train singers in something called foundational tone. So foundational tone for me is actually the union of breath and voice at that moment. And so many singers who have trouble with their chest voice specifically is quite often when they're trying to come into chest voice, what some singers are, they come in quite deep like this and it makes the vocal folds quite loose and you tend to get a lot of air coming through that as well. So that's a conceptual problem with thinking that chest voice equals depth, which it doesn't. Chest voice's main characteristic is actually brightness, but singers, they so often misconceive that and end up going for this part of it, which they see as chest, but that part of it is actually one of the more overwhelming parts of the tone in head voice, is a lot of low frequency EQ, if you like. So I tend to use something like, we practice those little glottal strokes the vocal cords come together, just lightly.
Yes.
And then, and they're so soft that they can be sort of not quite glottal and hard, but still firm in a way that brings the vocal cords together. Mm-hmm. And when we can get, then singers can eradicate that. Sometimes I also ask them to become aware of their throat, that they're not, not plunging it or, not lifting it up or crunching, but it becomes a closure of the vocal folds that comes with no, what I call, baggage.
I like that.
It's not pressing, it's not lifting, it's just the vocal cords do that and the throat does nothing else.
Yes.
Then that brings that sort of function back to the brain, I think. The brain goes, oh, okay, so this thing can happen independent of all these other things. And it's like, yes, it can. So I tend to help build that order of voicing by playing with very small movements like that and then gradually bringing sound to them.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of A Voice and Beyond. I hope you enjoyed it, as now is an important time for you to invest in your own self-care, personal growth, and education. Use every day as an opportunity to learn and to grow so you can show up feeling empowered and ready to live your best life. If you know someone who will also be inspired by this episode, please be sure to copy and paste the link and share it with them. Or share it on social media and use the hashtag #AVoiceAndBeyond. I promise you, I am committed to bringing you more inspiration and conversations just like this one every week. And if you would like to help me, please rate and review this podcast and cheer me on by clicking the subscribe button on Apple Podcasts right now. I would also love to know what it is that you most enjoyed about this episode and what was your biggest takeaway. Please take care, and I look forward to your company next time on the next episode of A Voice and Beyond.